And I have the Steve Collins is on the phone. Greg Gibbon is on the phone, as is Aaron Kaiser-Murray. Do you have anybody else on the phone?
Thanks for letting me do this, Steve. I wanted to be here for my husband's hot listeners visit. So, but I got the agenda up on my laptop.
Perfect.
And Steve here. Yes, I'm on my phone. It's a landline, so the connection should be good. But I appreciate this. I have to be in Vegas this week, and it's business. It's not pleasure. But it's great.
Although the location always raises those questions, right?
It adds a little bit to this.
Well, you may, for those of you in the room, I have a new face sitting next to me. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce Mr. Nate McDonald. He is our new Assistant Deputy Director. Nate, you want to fill us in?
All right. Happy to be here with you. Casey Cameron asked that I come here, who was originally scheduled to be here to represent John, and then she was not able to be here, so asked that I be here to represent John in the Executive Director's Office. I've been recently appointed to be the Assistant Deputy Director, which is a position that really is one within our Executive Director's Office to help in many different roles. I am the Communication Director for the department as well, and that has been my responsibility for nearly 3 years in the department. So, but I'm happy to be here and support this council and the good work you guys are doing.
And we included in the packet this beautiful org chart, so you can get an idea of where it puts them. Nate is over the, in addition to the Executive Director's Office Support, he also supports veterans and employer initiatives and STEM, which is science, technology,
engineering, and math.
A little side note, Ian, does someone on the phone have a comment?
No, it sounds great.
And the employer initiatives are largely funded through our funds based on penalty of interest of the overcompensation program. So we take the money that we collect from penalties and interest we're assessed, and we reinvest it in the economy with the authority of the legislature to help create more jobs.
When Diane was new, she had to do the both chicken dance. Are you ready for that, Nate?
I
remember Diane. Did you remember?
I did.
You have the costume from my old work. We would make them wear the actual mascot.
No, but Miguel can sing it.
After that happened, they banned alcohol.
Welcome,
Nate. Thank you. Yes. All right. Last meeting was on December 1st. Assuming we've all received copies of the minutes, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 No opposed? All right.
Okay, we'll go ahead and move on to the trust funds, which is why everyone's here today, right? So it is currently April 20th. Employers are in the midst of filing their quarterly reports from the January through March period. Those are due to the department by April 30th. This is going to be the first time that employers are experiencing the 2017 contribution rate. Last quarter, Mike, did we have 91% file online?
Correct.
The beauty of filing online is it becomes available immediately. We don't need to wait for data entry. Okay.
Is there a power switch on in the back?
There is. Let's go ahead and move on to the next slide. And so for the trust funds. Essentially, the status of the fund is healthy. You'll see a copy of this chart in your packet. A couple things. The current balance of the trust fund is $991 million. Essentially, with accounting for the increase in covered wages over the last 15 years, the expansion of the minimum and maximum parameters for what constitutes a healthy trust fund, right now we're actually in the healthiest point of our trust fund at least 15 years. Very valid. So when we ran the analysis at the end of fiscal year 2016, so last June, we found out that we were a little over $1 million above that maximum level. And as you know, our formula is statutorily written to say that if you get above the maximum level, then the reserve factor, the views on employers with recent unemployment experience, decreases. So it went from a 1 to a 0.95. When we looked at that $1 million over the max and what it meant for these employers, we figured it was an average of about, Martha, was it $29 per employer?
Yes, it was.
We did that math. So we actually have it flagged for this coming July once we have the June 30th salary. We're going to go through and see how far above the max we are. And what that works out to for employers. And I know we've got a council meeting set up in August. I think that would be a great time for discussion. Looking beyond fiscal year 17, and I know in these projections we just have fiscal year 17 displayed, but looking beyond, it is possible that if wages continue to increase at their current rate, eventually you'll see those blue maximum min and max lines increasing to the point that we're no longer above the maximum, but now we're within the range, just because we're ensuring more wages within the economy. That requires a forecast out to calendar year 2020, and it's not quite something I'm willing to stake my reputation on just yet. So it'll require out for a forecast. nationally, I wanted to get an update on where Utah stands in relation to other states. There are still 8 states that are considered to have an insolvent trust fund, meaning that they do not have a viable balance. The amount that they owe in recovering from the most recent recession is still higher than the amount that they have in their trust fund. There are 24 states that are somewhere between insolvent and minimally solvent. And that minimally solvent is parameters set by the Department of Labor. It basically means that the state has enough money in their trust fund to pay at least 1 year of benefits if they were to experience another recession. So we've got 8 states that are not even considered solvent, and then 24 that are somewhere between solvent and minimally solvent. So Utah is in a very healthy place comparatively, and on its own. We're considered the 4th healthiest in the nation. So let's go ahead and move on to the next slide, where we've got the graph regarding total minimum adequate, minimum maximum. So as of right now, employers are just experiencing that fiscal year 2017 tax rate. Looking ahead to what 2018 looks like, and of course this is all projected because we're starting off the year, we are expecting to have stability with the reserve factor. So when we talked rates in the last meeting, we discussed how about 75% of Utah employers currently qualify for the minimum rate of 0.2%, which works out to $66 per employee per year. The employers that qualify for that minimum rate, the health of the trust fund doesn't mean anything to them because they aren't paying for any of the recent unemployment experience. It's the 25% of employers that don't qualify for the minimum rate where the trust fund reserve factor is going to impact how much they pay in addition to their benefit costs. And so that reserve factor is projected right now to remain steady in calendar year 17 and calendar year 18 at 0.95. We are expecting, right now the minimum rate is 0.2%. We're expecting that come next year, that minimum rate has a high chance of going down to 0.1%. So essentially that would take it from about $66 per employee to about $33 per employee. And the reason for that is because the biggest reason for that is that we have less employers that are going out of business, so we're not having to absorb that within the social cost. And we also have less employers that are maxing out on their rate. So that should be a good bump for employers coming out of making.
Hey, Michelle, can you remind me on the reserve factor formula, the statutory formula, what is the floor for that? Can it continue to drop until it's outside of the if we're above the maximum, can it continue to drop, or is there a floor on that?
So it does continue to drop, and I believe 0.05 is enough. And Martha, do you know right offhand the minimum amount that our reserve back goes to?
Right now, for which year?
Yeah, the lowest. I'm talking about what is the lowest that it can drop. If we continue to be above the maximum, and it drops in sort of 50 basis points increments, is there a floor on that?
I don't have that information quite at hand, Michelle, but I can come back to you.
Okay. Well, so we'll follow up with the council on the arrangement for that. I would be fairly surprised if it said it would get down to zero.
I would guess that it wouldn't, but I don't know what that floor is, whether it's 8.95 or
floor. We'll get back to you on that. All right, any other questions regarding this table? Okay, let's go ahead and move on to the next one. This is one of our more complicated graphs that we show, and essentially what this is, the green bars in the background represent the unemployment trust fund balance at the end of the fiscal year. The blue lines represent the fluctuation in benefits paid year to year, and the red line is the amount of contributions that are collected. So you see that there's this countercyclical relationship as benefits increase, then gradually contributions don't increase until a few years later. And the reason we maintain this countercyclical relationship is ideally we don't want tax rates to increase significantly in the midst of a recession. We try to have that delay a few years after during the economic recovery so that we can replenish the trust fund. So for those of you that had the opportunity to go to the Governor's Economic Summit, Natalie Bachner provided an excellent graph showing economic recovery and addressed this whole idea of Utah is due for another recession because another year has passed. Seeing that every 7 or 8 years, like clockwork, we should be entering recession. And the graph that she showed was the average amount of time for economic recession in Utah. And the longest economic expansion was from 1991 to 2001, and then where we're at right now. And right now, we haven't quite reached that maximum economic expansion that we had from 1991 to 2001, but we are currently above the average in the amount of time that's passed since the last recession.
So once you say the bombs are
going to fall. You know, surprisingly, she didn't say that on the stage. So the whole point of this and the reason that we want to provide this to you today and that we appreciate the feedback from the council and the guidance from the council is being considered things to look out for. First of all, we want to make sure that we've got enough money in the unemployment trust fund so that we can pay out benefits to individuals who are eligible. Secondly, we want to make sure that we have enough money in the trust fund so that we can avoid major tax spikes in the middle of a recession when employers are doing the worst. But at the same time, we don't want to have too much money arbitrarily in the trust fund that we're preventing those dollars from falling into the economy. And so this monitoring, this exercise is all trying to do with those parameters. Any questions on trust funds?
I'll just make the comment that I think I think that the department, the council, in conjunction with the legislature, has done a good job setting up this statutory framework that is enabling us to stay healthy. It was not fun during the 2008, 2009, 2010 time frame. I don't think it was fun for anyone that's sitting around the table here, but the formula worked, and it kept us solvent when everyone else was insolvent, and so just hats off to the department and sort of staying the line and the council, even though it was tempting to start fiddling around this formula, staying the path, and it worked out well and for employers and employees alike. So.
Thank you for that, and we appreciate the support of the council. Any questions or comments on the phone?
Michelle, did you mention that there were three other states that were doing comparatively better than we are right now?
I have that in here.
They did not California.
Go ahead and take that. All right, so essentially Wyoming, Oregon, and Missouri.
Oregon amazes me.
So if you have any colleagues in either of those states, please raise the start of a little friendly petition. We can get the healthiest trust fund.
Got three random.
Michelle, that number is getting awfully close to where benefits paid is approaching taxes collected. Mm-hmm. Do you have any concerns about that? It looks like that trend is moving downward.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like 2008 all over again. What do you think?
So as we were projecting out for 2018, 19, and 20, we are currently projecting, which I didn't include in these documents, a potential increase in contributions paid. The reason being that depending on the rate that wages are growing, we're going to have more wages that need to be covered under unemployment insurance, and so rates, or not necessarily rates, but contributions in the amount collected could increase. When we look at the amount of benefits paid over the coming years, we rely on the Governor's Office of Management budget and what they're predicting for Utah's unemployment rate and how that configures into, of all of the individuals in the state that are unemployed, the percentage of them that actually end up collecting benefits, how is that going to change in the coming years? And it's expected to remain fairly stable with the possibility of a slight increase in, I think, 2018. Martha, it's expected to go from
3.3 to 3.5.
So from 3.3 to 3.5 in terms of our unemployment rate.
So if those numbers hold out, yeah, we'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So in an ideal world, if we could all be king and queen for a day, we would want these two lines to just be, straight line right on top of one another, so we can collect enough to cover benefit
mm-hmm.
and not taking extra money out of the economy
mm-hmm.
to, infuse back in for job growth and other things. Even funded by employer dollars. So if we over collect,
mm-hmm.
there's an implication to the economy as well. So just an editorial comment.
Mm-hmm. Particularly if you've got the what's represented by the green bars of a healthy balance.
So I have a couple of random questions. You may not be able to answer it. First one is, you mentioned the first few times, I think we're all seeing that average wages are increasing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any way to track that? Because if I were to ask you what the average wage increase percentage-wise is, you mentioned that.
So our, we have one of a handful of states that actually indexes the unemployment benefit amount to the average wage in the state of Utah. So it changes every year depending on that average wage. From 2016 to 2017, wage-based increase from, I believe it was 2.8%. And historically, we've seen it generally ranges anywhere from 0.5 to 3% of the highest we've seen in year to year.
Okay. So, and I think you already answered this. Currently, what is our state unemployment rate? Is it 3.2?
3.1.
Mm-hmm. And then, on a selfish note, do you know how many construction workers are now back in the
workforce? I don't have that right off hand, but we can definitely get that for you.
If you can call me on that, we've had several media outlets call and saying, use some pieces on the scarcity of particular construction workers. And Like those would be deemed to address this. I'm not sure they can answer that question.
Okay, absolutely. Something that I thought was interesting, when we're looking at claim volume, people that call into our center that file an unemployment claim and then go on to collect benefits, every year, kind of like clockwork, come October, November, when the cold weather starts hitting in, we see a significant increase in our claim volume. It peaks out sometime in January, and then it starts incrementally decreasing until probably about April or May. And so we track those trends of how fast did it increase and reach that peak, and how fast did it decrease back to the normal level. This year we were pretty much on target for when we started increasing and when we reached our peak. It is interesting to see that the kind of the recovery from that seasonal influx seems to be happening at a bit more of a rapid rate than it had in the previous year.
Our latest employment report is coming out tomorrow. We'll give us the latest numbers on the industry sectors as well.
That would be color important. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That's great.
All right, other thoughts on trust funds? Okay,
the moment you've all been waiting for, I'd like to introduce Ms. Kathy Fona. She'll provide an update on the 2017
legislative session. Is it too soon for some of you, or are you okay if we... I'm
still getting cold sweats at night.
Ever since the alcohol left the room.
But we have to roll on. So this was a pretty busy session for the department, and we were involved in a lot of different things, from homelessness to affordable housing to employment issues, kind of years ago. And Medicaid issues always tying in. It's a myriad of issues we get pulled into, but it was a very successful session for our agency. We feel really good about how we came out. We didn't get any of our general fund savings, yay. Only some CANA payments, yay. So we consider those funds. And then we got all the money that we asked for. On top of that, there were several bills, well, many bills that passed that touch us, but I'll just go over the ones that are most pertinent to this advisory council. So the first one is HB 34. If you guys remember, we are able, under the code, to share information with the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor. There are certain criteria when we can share the information, when we can't, on those employers who misclassify the workers. This bill just extended the sunset on that part of code because we, at this point, haven't really had an opportunity to share information and see whether or not this is a good relationship to have. So this extends it to July 1 of 2019. Michelle, do you know how many times we've shared info at this point? I forgot to ask you.
We shared it twice.
So we'll have 2 years to continue sharing, and then the legislature is interested in us evaluating whether or not this is a good relationship to have, whether it's a benefit to the state or not, and then they'll make a decision then on whether or not we get to continue. So there's that.
Kevin?
Yes?
Maybe Michelle, will you just keep us up to date on that process? I think it's something that we were all really concerned about. We needed the debt collectors to a little concerned about the sharing with Wage and Hour. And if you can keep us up to date and just sort of give us reports about when that was happening, because I think that we built some pretty good fences around when it is that that data can be shared, and really it sounds like when we have a totally uncooperative employer that's not willing to sort of step up and make the changes, that's when you transmit the data over. And we're all for getting malingerers and bad actors out of it.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. We build a lot of fences to protect the good employers, and these are ones that just sunk to the bottom. So,
right. So if you don't want to say that for a while, okay, I do have those numbers.
Okay.
And so from July of 2015 to December of 2016, so that's about a year and a half.
This is in our packet, right?
Or what's that?
That if you're looking at, is not in our
packet. So during that time period, we had 557 companies that were found to have misclassified workers. Of those, 163 actually had 10 or more misclassified workers. And as you may remember, that was one of the sentences that we built within the legislation to say only for those with 10 or more workers. So of the 163 companies, we had a total of 12 that failed to cure the misclassification as defined within the statute and the administrative rule. So that works out to 7.4% of employers with 10 or more misclassified workers failed to comply with the department before we shared it with wage and hour division. And then 2.2% of all total audits have misclassified workers. So as we had expected, like you said, there's a lot of people that maybe either don't understand the system or want to comply with the system or they become aware of it. It's just a very small piece that fails to comply with the amount that is classified.
Continuing on, we'll continue. The next bill I'm going to discuss is HB 272. This is called the Regulatory Impact Amendment. What this does is any time an agency wants to file an administrative rule, update one of our administrative rules, and we have a lot of administrative rules that govern the Unemployment Insurance Division, we now have to do an analysis on the fiscal impact to small and large, well, all businesses in the state, but point out small businesses as well as large, the different types of industries that will be impacted. I mean, there's a list of things we have to analyze and report out on before the rule can be put out for public comment and then finalized. The Governor's Office of Management and Budget is required to set the criteria on how we do this analysis. I've heard that they may hire someone who would do the analysis for all the different agencies. I'm a little fearful of the bottleneck that might create because we do as an agency file a lot of rules, but it does look like the legislature wants us to really ensure we understand what an impact each rule will have on businesses in the state. So that's a new one.
Do they have a time they have to turn that decision around, or is it open?
It's open. Before public comment, but you know, as far as the current rules in place, I mean, we have set deadlines, and if they're not filed in time, they will become ineffective, and therefore they don't carry the weight of law. So we would have those deadlines chasing us in GOMD as well as we went through that. And then we also have the deadline, anytime a new bill gets passed in session and there's rulemaking mentioned within the bill, we have 180 days from the effectiveness of that bill to get those rules filed. So that deadline would also be changing us as well. The next bill, SB 65, this one's interesting. This was Senator Maine. He's a character, I really enjoy him. This one is about postal facilities and government services. So if Congress, it's going to take an act of Congress, as that phrase goes, if they allow it, this bill allows the state agencies in Utah to contract with the postal service for them to provide state agency services within their facilities. We don't have any plans as an agency to enter into those agreements. We would only do so if it was a more efficient way to run our business. But we have employment centers in almost every county except for Daggett, right? So we already have facilities available to all our customers. But it was an interesting bill. We maybe can contract with USPS. They might have space. Well, and I think the goal is, you know, the revenue in those facilities has gone down, and so they're trying to find creative ways to maybe boost it back up.
Yeah.
But it would only make sense for us to do so if it costs less money. It would only make sense otherwise, right? Let's see. SB 71. I didn't really have any involvement with this one, but criminal accounts receivable amendments. Basically, this bill creates criminal judgment account receivable, and so if someone had a judgment against them from a criminal proceeding, it allows the court to, based on different criteria, turn those into civil judgments and then pass the buck over to the state debt collection office to then start receiving those funds. That would apply when we do any kind of criminal prosecution on our customers or lawyers who committed fraud.
Yo, please ask. So we, of all of the overpayments that we set up as a division, we have a very small percentage that are actually related to fraudulent activity from the claimant. These would be a situation where someone goes to file their weekly claim, and it goes during the week, did you work? And they say no. And then later we find out that they actually did work during the week and they had unreported earnings. That's a potential for fraud. For, we have ethics and priority, but we do have statutory authority that when fraud happens, we can take it for criminal prosecution. I believe it's a third degree felony, although sometimes that does get pled down to a class A or B misdemeanor. And so this bill is saying that in situations where we found unemployment insurance fraud, the amount that they owe the agency could be referred to the Office of State Debt Collection for collection. Historically, we have elected not to use the Office of Debt Collection, and we've done those collections internally, primarily because state debt collection requires taking a fee off of the cost of debt collection, and our regulations say that any money collected has to be deposited into the trust fund, and so we do it ourselves so we can do it directly into the trust fund.
You're welcome.
So I guess we'll need to work that out. We'll work that out.
The next bill, SB 224, this is the one that we ran as an agency. It has several things, minor ticky tacky issues, in my opinion. We got the Vocational Rehabilitation Division rulemaking authority. It has the rulemaking authority. This is part of the Utah State Office of Rehabilitation that merged with our agency last year, last October, right? This is one of their divisions that focuses on getting people with disabilities employed or higher education so they can get employment. So we got them rulemaking authorities because they have an appeals process too. They're granting benefits and not granting benefits, so there's an appeals process, and it just makes sense to have the weight of law supporting whatever decisions they're making in regard to benefits. We added business representatives to the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities. So we felt like a stronger connection between industry and those who represent disabled people, having a greater connection there serves all. We modified how the Qualified Emergency Food Agency's fund is distributed. You've probably never, I don't know, maybe you've heard this fund. Dave, maybe you've heard this fund. I don't know.
I've heard this fund.
You heard this fund. So the way it was structured in code was preventing us from being able to distribute all the funds that were being deposited in every year from the general fund account. And so we removed all of the bottlenecks out of the code, and we gave the flexibility to the Housing and Community Development Division to create rules on how to disperse it, and that way they can have flexibility as the economy changes, they'll be able to disperse those funds completely. These funds go to food pantries that pay for their operations, for staff, all of that kind of we also extended the sunset on the Office of Rehabilitation Transition Account. So when USOR came over to us, we had to do a fun accounting game of creating this big pool account where we're pulling their money in, we're pulling our money in, and then figuring out where it was all going to play out. Because they still had accounts receivables, we had accounts, you know, so how are we going to make sure we can cover their past expenses, cover their future? We created a big account. And we're going to extend it till July 2018, so we have time to really make sure we understand how all the accounting needs to play out. We removed my shop, the appeal shop, that hears appeals of UI cases. We removed our ability to set attorney fees. Remember the Supreme Court case that said, hey, legislature, hey, executive branch, you guys don't get to set
HBU. So we went ahead and followed the case law and removed our ability to do that. But we retained our ability to set fees on those who are representing clients who are not attorneys to make sure they're not taking advantage of employees or employers. So that's basically all we did in our bill. The SB 249 tax e-filing amendment, Michelle, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically this requires employers, all employers in the state, to file their quarterly with blue returns to the tax commission in electronic format. And so I guess we would look at that and say, hey, maybe it's time for UI to now require 100% compliance in filing electronic format. I'll let, if you want to talk more about that, mm-hmm. That's
so I believe it was last session they ran a bill where employers filing their annual W-2 files were required to do it electronically with the state tax commission. And so in the unemployment insurance quarterly employer advisor, we included an article to inform employers of this new annual electronic requirement. In speaking with the tax commission, they have a very strong participation rate. And so they decided to run legislation this session that would now make not just the annual report, but also the quarterly filing mandatory electronic. And so with our shop currently being at about 91% electronic filing, we are looking at all possible ways of increasing that to 100%, or at least to 98%.
Do you feel like there's a point at which, I mean, we've got what we're going to get. There's a certain percentage that just, it doesn't matter how awesome or attractive that you make it, it's just not going to happen.
Highly possible. And we've been chipping away at it for the last, I believe, 3 years. We started our initiative when we were at 79%, and through going through making the initiative and the administrative effort, we've gotten it up to 91. Would be curious in the council's opinion whether or not this is something that you feel would be a good thing, a bad thing, neutral.
So I think electronic filing is awesome. It's great, but I would want to see the 9% who are not filing. What do those employers look like? You know, what sort of burden might it place on them to do electronic filing? I'm assuming that they're doing paper filing for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the owner is 102 years old and so a couple of years younger than Dale, and doesn't know how. And I'd just be curious to see why it is that they're still 9% of filing by paper. Because, I mean, they file electronically. It's great. I think it's great for the department. You get all the data that comes in, and it's clean and nice and things like that. But I also want to be sensitive that there are teeny small businesses that e-filing would be an extreme burden on them. You want to be sensitive.
How similar is their tax quarterly filing? If they have to do that electronically, how similar is that to what they would have to report
to the official?
Is it so similar that now that they're forced to go to the tax commission, even without us implementing anything, they'll more than likely increase their electronic reporting with us? I wonder if it's similar enough that she's like, it'd be easier for them.
I think it goes back to your point. I've been reflecting a lot, actually. Our agency serves about 60,000 people a year in poverty. And Pam Perlick just came and did some work with our board to help us understand technology in relation to our demographics. But the population that is just aging out, that might be those small business owners that miss the technology bubble, that even now, folks that are under the age of 70 are there's like this bubble that's popping, and then this population that is all electronic, mm-hmm. and they're going to age as well. But they already were in the technology era, so it's highly likely that it will trend out, mm-hmm. that there'll be a natural attrition to using the technology.
Okay, so the last one that passed that I'm going to talk about is SB 194. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the UCOD Data Alliance. It wasn't functioning very well, and so what Senator Enderich did is move it into GWS and kind of revamped it. It's called the Utah Data Research Center, and it's going to be created under our Workforce Research and Analysis Division, the division that calculates unemployment rates and all of the kind of jobs that are just in existence, the need for jobs, things like that. So it'll be created under them, and there's an advisory board that will be created to help manage the program as it goes forward. But basically, they're going to be collecting a lot of data from USDE, UCAT, and UT. Different sources will be collecting it, and so we can conduct longitudinal studies that show whatever that data can show. And the center will receive requests, and they'll prioritize those requests for longitudinal studies. But basically, the point of it is to inform public policy in the city, so that when we're making, the legislature's making decisions, any of us are making decisions for the state, we can do it based on some real data analysis.
Where was it located before?
You know, it wasn't located under one entity, and I think that was part of the problem, is it was all these different partners, but no one really owning it and controlling it. And so all the same partners are involved, but now it's within the executive branch, so there's some oversight, and the legislature can hold our feet to the fire.
How long has it been around?
Just a few years. Yeah. But we're excited about it. We think we can do some good things with it, and we're hopeful that we can provide lots of analysis that can guide policy. Those are the ones that passed that I think touched us at council. There were a couple that didn't pass. HB 144, this bill was being run by Representative Hall, and it was going to require all the administrative law judges in the state to have a Juris Doctorate degree. And I was very happy that we're able to. I have one of those degrees, but I did not like this bill. So, because my shop, we have about 10 administrative law judges, 2 are attorneys, the rest are not, and there is no difference in the quality and the accuracy of their decisions. And I like to keep the door open to as many people as possible the opportunity to hold that kind of a position. So I was anti. And me and Paul went the rounds, and we won. So I'm hopeful it doesn't come up again. SB 254 is the other one. This one is about...
Leave that other one.
Yeah.
Aren't the ALJ subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct?
Yeah.
So and they fall under that umbrella, whether they're attorneys or not.
That's right. Yep. Absolutely true. They have to be ethical as well. I mean, they have to follow all the rules, even though they didn't graduate from a law school. SB 254 is Senator Stevenson's bill. I'm probably going to let Michelle talk about this one the most, but this one is where potentially you're going to require occupational codes to be reported by employers to the Unemployment Insurance Division. It didn't really get any traction. There was confusion on why it was being run and who was asking for it to be run. So it was never heard in committee. But I don't know if you want to say anything else or... Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we as an agency were neutral. The governor's office was neutral. We were just like, if this is what the legislature thinks, we'll stand on the sidelines. But...
What's their purpose?
Why do they? I think the idea is that if we can know actual titles attached to the wages that are coming in, if we can even know the hourly rate that's coming in, we'll have better data. So we can analyze the effects that education is having on industry. Right now, we can't really tie that gap with data because we don't know what their job title is. We don't know exactly what they're doing. We just know how much the wage, their quarterly wages are. So it makes it difficult to bridge that gap. So I guess that would be the purpose of doing it, but it would put a significant burden on employers potentially to report that additional information. And there would be a pretty significant fiscal impact to our agency as far as you know, changing our programming to accept that information, to be able to clean the data because it's self-reporting, and are they self-reporting the right stuff? So we'd have to clean the data, and then any analysis that's going to take place based on that data would have a cost as well. So it sounds simple and easy, but in the end, it's pretty complicated. But I do think that the data would be beneficial, but it's whether or not it outweighs the cost is the question.
So it's quite a as Kelly Valley Council may know, this is an issue that comes up every couple of years. In fact, I had the great fortune of stumbling on a memo from 1987 in the dark recesses of my desk. It was quite snarky. So it's an ongoing issue that keeps coming up. And right now it has particular traction given the national atmosphere for under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. What can we do to make sure that state agencies and community partners and educational institutions are working together to really fill the jobs, not just that employers have today, but that employers are going to have in the future that may not be identified yet. And so I believe that there are currently about four or five other states that either have beginning negotiations, I'm not quite sure there's actual bills out there, to add occupational title to wage records. In fact, there are a few states that are also thinking about requiring that those wage records be reported on a monthly basis. As of right now, there are only two states in the nation that require occupational code with wage records. One of them has been doing it for 20 or 30 years, and so it's just a way of life for their employers. The other one just started. Within the last few years, they did a two-year intensive outreach to employers to help them get their systems ready to ease the reporting requirements for it. They call it mandatory, however, employers are not penalized for failing to report occupational codes. And the way that that legislation was written in the state results in a lot of records that have occupational title that hasn't been validated. So, for example, you might have a smaller company with 20 employees, and 18 of those employees are reported as CEOs. And if it's not validated, you can't necessarily draw conclusions on that data. And they also have 20% of their records with no occupational titles. So there's a challenge in having that in their legislation because it's not a valid basis on which to do economic analysis. So this particular bill, Senate Bill 254, I wish we could have the council together prior to it being proposed, because I think it was a great discussion. The way that it was written was it didn't have a phase-in period that was going to penalize employers. If you fail to report it, then we would assess a non-reporting penalty with the first offense. And that was how they were going to kind of get around from having these blank records. So I think, as Kathy mentioned, there was some confusion in the way that this bill was written as to who was asking for it and what the emphasis was for asking for it. In the grand scheme of things, this is clearly an issue and it's definitely not going to go away. I've been working with my counterpart, Carrie Ding, over the labor market, our workforce research analysis, to really be able to articulate what are the tangible benefits that an employer could experience from having this increased reporting burden.
That's it for me. Let's take a turn. I'm good to go back over here.
I'll just add as a part of, we're very fortunate to have Kathy blowing up on the hill.
Nice.
She works with Bell Ops up there and knows everything that's going on and keeps us out of trouble. And when if we do get in trouble, she gets us out of it. She does a phenomenal job.
All
right. Wanted to give you a little treat, as it were. If we can go to the slide that has the digital for employers. So, integrity. Paying benefits only to individuals when they're eligible to receive payments as a pillar of the unemployment insurance program. And so we recently, as an agency, contracted with a third-party communications department and created two different videos. This first one is intended for employers, and it basically goes through and talks about the purpose of the unemployment insurance program and addresses some of the common reasons that we have improper payments in our program. And all of our, Mike, is it 28 field lockers? Each of our 28 field auditors that goes out into employers goes to Burgess and say, please show me your payroll records. We want to make sure that you are correctly identifying your employees and reporting their wages. The auditors have this video loaded on their laptop, and they use it as an education opportunity, kind of a different way of presenting the information. So let's go ahead and play up the council.
Unemployment insurance plays a vital role in keeping the economy strong and maintaining a skilled local workforce. Unemployment benefits provide temporary, partial income replacement for qualified individuals. This program allows unemployed workers to continue to support their families and to maintain purchasing power as they seek new work, helping keep businesses in business and a skilled workforce in Utah. In fact, the primary responsibility of an individual filing for unemployment benefits is to become re-employed. Before payment is released, an individual certifies each week that they're able to work, available to immediately accept work, and are conducting an active job search. As an employer, your quarterly unemployment insurance contributions are used to provide benefits. More than 70,000 active employers report their wages to Workforce Services every quarter, with about 9 out of 10 companies doing this online at jobs.utah.gov. This information is then used to ensure that unemployment benefits are being paid accurately and responsibly. Accountability is of the utmost importance, and Utah employers help us hold individuals filing for unemployment benefits accountable. We review the quarterly wage reports you submit and unemployment benefits that have been paid to former employees to calculate your unemployment contribution rate each year and determine the eligibility of individuals filing for unemployment benefits. We also review your quarterly wage reports to make certain that individuals are accurately reporting any earnings that they may receive from part-time employment while still claiming benefits. This reduces overpayments that may impact your unemployment contribution rate. Workforce Services actively detects, prevents, and prosecutes fraudulent activity. If a concern arises, please visit jobs.utah.gov. With all of this in mind, it's important to remember that the primary responsibility of an individual filing for unemployment benefits is to become re-employed. Workforce Services offers meaningful re-employment resources in our more than 30 employment centers across Utah. You can post jobs and search our database of job seekers to meet your workforce needs at jobs.utah.gov. For questions on accurately reporting wages or to keep your business contact information current, visit jobs.utah.gov or call 801-526-9235. The unemployment insurance program is most effective when your company is successful and you're hiring Utah's skilled workforce. With your help, we can keep Utah's skilled labor force gainfully employed for years to come.
So we currently have it when employers log into our website, they automatically get a My Employer to Do list, and we've got it at the top there for them to watch. And we're also including it as we go out in the community presentation as part of that. Here's what we do and why it matters.
Yeah. Can other people use it?
Yes. It's available on our website. Mm-hmm. And we don't have time to play it today, but we did develop another video for individual filing for unemployment. and it really focuses on that work surge and reporting any earnings from part-time work. So the link will be included in the agenda. This summer, we're going to be rolling out enhancements to our system so that the very first week that an individual files for benefits, that will become required viewing in hopes of helping them understand the parameters of the program and also understanding how to avoid the improper payments. All right, so in regards to the next couple things on the agenda, we do have a handout in your packet regarding the debt collector program. So I would encourage you to review that. We talked about the volume of requests and some audits that we've been doing on debt collection entities. We've also included a Sam's draft, a one-page handout. This is that Department of Labor, Wage and Hour Division information sharing. We were brainstorming additional ways that we could avoid having employers get into that failure experiment classification. And so now whenever we go out and do field audits with an employer, if we find that they've misclassified workers, we give them this paper so that they understand other entities that might be impacted based on the employment status. And then with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn the time over to Nate for some major activities from the program.
All right. You make this really quick, but I was told that there was a request to learn more about what the department's involvement is with the intergenerational poverty effort at the state level. We are the state agency that is the support agency for all the activities with intergenerational poverty. And so with that, those of you, this doctor I'm giving you kind of tells you what is intergenerational poverty. It is something unique that the state of Utah is doing. No other state is tackling poverty in this way, where we've really gone after data to better understand kind of the difference between intergenerational poverty and situational poverty. And really, intergenerational poverty is just that you have multiple generations who are relying on health assistance for a certain period of time, year after year. And we've been able to track that and then identify through data, sharing with the Department of Workforce Services, Department of Health, Department of Human Services, Public Education, and also the Juvenile Justice Center, just really aggregate all that data and identify indicators and really focus our efforts on what those indicators are. And we've really narrowed it down to four key indicators that we're seeing that really impact intergenerational poverty, specifically with children. Our efforts on intergenerational poverty to break it is focusing on the children and the family as a whole. And there's four key areas of child well-being that we're really that been identified through our data that we're focusing on. And that begins with early childhood development. Erin's very familiar with that. We did our press event at her one of her locations because of that. But and then education is the second one, family economic stability, and health. So as a state right now, we really have kind of taken the next step. The first few years has really been focusing on gathering all the data, sharing the data, working closely with the other commission agencies to now be able to understand the data and start moving into action. And one of the key things that we're doing is working with the counties, specifically rural counties, that are most greatly impacted by intergenerational poverty. Let me throw out a couple of data number figures for you. State of Utah, as a whole, we're seeing intergenerational poverty. Children in intergenerational poverty is just under 50,000 children that are in intergenerational poverty. When you add in children who are at risk, with the children that are in intergenerational poverty, that number is like close to over 230,000. And that's where this has really caught the attention of legislators, really the community, and a number of people across the board, that this is an issue we're tackling and really focusing on. And so we're really moving to that next step of data going into action. We're working with these counties. Right now we've identified 10 rural counties that have the highest percentage of their children that are in intergenerational poverty. And we're working with them to build a plan, a local plan, local solutions to be able to identify and start addressing this in their communities, and we're supporting them in that. In addition, we have two urban counties that are focusing on it as well, Utah County and Weber County. Those plans are due to us on June 2nd. Once we get those plans, we're going to really be evaluating them and looking at common themes and threats that the state can help out across the board, but also to start seeing these counties move forward. So it's a really interesting time and exciting time for the state to be tackling this issue, addressing it, but really doing it in kind of a different way of focusing, one, on the data, and then also making it be a local solution-driven process for the counties to get involved. All the data is online. The bottom of this says you go to intergenerationalpoverty.utah.gov. It's kind of long, but if you go to that, it just takes you to a web page on our site that will that gives you all the resources you need. It gives the latest report, gives a video of the Lieutenant Governor, gives a video breaking down, has this tool on it. It also has recommendations that have come from the committee. So just encourage you to go out to that site, dive into it, and get to know it a little bit better. I know we're over time. The last thing I just wanted to throw out to you that we're also very actively involved is that employers may be interested in or may have heard about it is this effort that the governor announced called Talent Ready Utah. And it's an effort that workforce development is a key issue right now in the state. It's a big issue, and there's been a lot of players focusing in on it over the last few years. Talent Ready Utah is really an effort to kind of bring all those players together from Department of Workforce Services, the Governor's Office of Economic Development, public education, the Applied Technology College system, the higher education system, bring all those players together and really start building out and working on on workforce development and work-based learning opportunities together. And the key focus is kind of twofold. How do we get more businesses involved in work-based learning opportunities, in partnering with education? And then two, how do we get students, citizens, involved who want to improve their employment situations to now get involved in these work-based learning and training programs to get these better high-skilled, higher-paying jobs. So that was kind of the other big issue, and we're front center on that part of the executive board for Talent Ready Utah. So, any questions on those two things?
On the intergenerational poverty, you said about 50,000 are at risk. What's the total state population? Is that 3.5 million?
Yeah, it's sort of 2 million. That's 50,000 that are in intergenerational poverty.
Oh, that's about 1.5%.
Yeah, but when we're talking that are at risk, it's a third of our
30,000.
Yeah, a third of our children.
People get hard on talent with you about that stuff.
Yeah.
I am not that. That's our biggest issue right now. We cannot find workers. It's a real problem.
It's at the beginning stages, and we'll update you more on this as it grows. I think it's probably something that, you know, definitely agree, like the council know what's happening with that and my involvement with it.
You know, it's not just the skilled workers, it's workers, period.
Yeah.
It's any worker, bring them in, if they can breathe, we'll train them. I mean, it's really fast.
Yeah. Well, I know over time. And there's this one last thing that we needed to bring to your attention. The Division of Unemployment Insurance Division is doing very well. We received an award just yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
We're excited about that. But we do have some sad news, and that there's some changes that are taking place in the leadership. So, with that, I'm going to let Michelle tell you.
I have submitted my resignation to the workforce service list, and in 2 weeks, I'm going to be joining another state corporation to essentially dedicate my resources to getting them up to speed and helping them to become high performers like you have done. Right now, I'm not at liberty to disclose details on what state it is if they simply notify their staff. But if I didn't feel 100% confident that we have a solid, stable program, I wouldn't even consider leaving. And so Utah's in a good place. Mr. Mike Miller over here is my chief of contributions. He will help along with his counterpart, Justin Williams, who just happens to be outside of the state to accept this award that Nate mentioned, will ensure that we continue to run a solid, stable program. So I'd like to thank this council for the excellent insight and input that you provided us as we reach these heights.
I'm not sure whether to congratulate you.
Right. Congratulations on the big award. I was gonna make sure that was brought up. That's fantastic, and it's a real loss. It's a real loss for Utah for you to leave, but come back.
So for some of us that our guests have been not out of the loop, what award was it? I think you got to make a motion. I'll second.
All right. I'll make a motion to applaud the staff and Michelle's leadership on the award from the National Association of State Workforce Agencies for outstanding performance in handling unemployment claims through an electronic system. Is that right?
Nice. Wow.
Well, I know John is here. He definitely appreciates the solid work Michelle has done. Also, definitely want the council know that he's very committed to the division, and it won't be long before there's announcement of the climate transition plan and what will happen there. But very committed to this division, and it is in good hands. It's done amazing work, and we'll continue to do that. So. With that, is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.